We are in business. So, for those who were here last week, thank you for a fun discussion. This was easily my favorite in terms of actually feeling like, okay, the bet is done. We now know, or we think we know, what has happened. Of course, pending chapter 42, where we get God's verdict on the conversation. But it, having that conversation of, so has Satan won? What exactly is Io's standing at this point? Has he passed the test? For those who were not here, I will not tell you what the conclusion was. You will have to listen to the recording or watch the video or something. But at this point, we move on to chapter 32. I should also note that as I put on the source sheets, this class, today's class, is dedicated by the Turk family in memory of Yitzhak ben Achaver Moshe. Elihu is odd. There are no two ways around it. Elihu is bona fide strange in the sense that this book should be over. This should have been it. We should be able to like spend the rest of the year on, I don't know, Ezra or something. The friends are done. Job is done. All that's left is for God to respond. But instead of that happening, the next several chapters, 32, 33, 34, 35, 36, 37, are going to be speeches by somebody named Elihu, who is going to insist that he must speak because he's outraged at what everybody else has said, and they're missing the point, they're not saying enough, and he's going to set everything straight. And then, when he's done speaking, the book's going to resume. God's going to talk, and he's not going to address what Elihu said. Job is not going to address what Elihu said. God is going to address what the other visitors said. It's not as though what God is going to say is going to be separate from what's been happening altogether. It's as though Elihu never happened. Leading some, in fact, to conclude that this is somehow a later addition to the book. Because it's just like, it's just parachuted in and then the book goes back to where it was. It's a very difficult thing, understanding what Elihu is doing. And what I wanted to do was actually to read to you from Newsom's conclusion of the book, because she does something here that I thought was just brilliant, but it was too long for me to retype it. For those who have the book, it's page 259. And she begins her conclusion by describing Job as a play and the way it would look to the audience. So listen to this. Onto a semi-darkened stage the actors walk. They're dressed in abstract costumes that evoke a vaguely medieval quality, as though they had arrived to play the drama of Everyman. The narrator takes his space to stage left, while Job occupies the center. As the narrator begins the story of Job, a man there was in the land of Uz, Job and his children begin to mime the parts they are given. As they move into their tableau, the scene of the council in heaven unfolds its role to stage right, thus the players enact the prose tale of Job. As they complete the drama of the prose tale's chapters 1 and 2, Job's three friends gather about him, sitting in silence. Suddenly, a light picks up an echoing group of four actors, situated toward the front left of the stage. They're clearly in the same postures of Job and his three friends, but they are costumed very differently. In the rich robes one might associate with a 19th century Shakespearean performance. And now she's shifting into the poem part. Job begins to speak in accents and diction sharply different from the Job character of the morality play, "Damn the day I was born," and so forth. Over the course of 2 hours, the friends and Job debate the issues of the wisdom dialogue, the experience of turmoil, the plausibility of the moral order of the world, the nature of God, the possibility of justice. And she goes on, I'm going to skip a little bit. At this same moment, at the end of the speeches of the wisdom dialogue, the characters enacting it freeze in their stance, with Job hostilely confronting his fellows. After several seconds of silence, a disembodied voice comes over the sound system. "There is a mine for silver, but where can wisdom be found?" As this voice finishes its haunting poetic speech, the character of Job, from the group of actors playing the wisdom dialogue, gets up from that tableau vivant, and moves across to the center front of the stage. No longer talking to the actors who play the friends, he speaks directly to the audience with passionate sincerity. Oh, that I were as in months gone by. I hope you're recognizing this from like the different parts of the book. As Job concludes his extraordinary oath to an audience that reacts with profound but not entirely unembarrassed silence, that silence is broken by a member of the audience who stands up and announces himself, Elihu Barachel. To the astonishment of the rest of the audience, this person refuses to sit down until he has finished a long and passionate, if not entirely comprehensible, response. The audience wonders, was he scripted? Was this a genuine bit of audience reaction? In either case, his evocation of a divine theophany provides the transition to the play's climactic moment, God's speech from the whirlwind. And then it goes on with the whirlwind. It's a very good description, especially when you get to her description of Job's final words at the end of the book. But the point that she's trying to make with this particular segment is, we don't know what Elihu is doing here. He sounds like, and he introduces himself as, somebody from the audience who's been watching what's been going on, listening to the conversations, can't believe that everybody else is so foolish, and he's going to set them straight. But he's going to talk for 5 chapters, and we're going to have no clue what he said. Not no clue what he said. We'll have some clue what he said, let's be fair. But
not even afterwards?
Well, you'll see. And he is a big, big challenge. It's not at all clear what in the world he's doing in this story, and he's going to speak for, it's 6 chapters, right? 32, 33, 34, 35, 36, 37. They will be 4 speeches. 32 and 33 are 1 speech. Chapter 34 is its own speech. Chapter 35 is its own, and then 36 and 37 are their own. There are bizarre contradictions about him. He's been silent the entire time, but he's been there paying attention. And you see it, because he actually quotes many of the earlier speeches. It's clear, he's been in the room the whole time while this has been going on, however long it's been playing out. He isn't part of the three. His genealogy is different, and presented differently. He addresses Job by name repeatedly, which they did not do. He acts as though he is part of the group in certain ways, and that he's addressing them. But he's not sort of with everybody. He doesn't seem to say anything new, even though he insists that he will. But there are elements that sort of hint at new ways to look at things. And as I said before, his speech doesn't belong in the sense that nobody answers him. He's going to speak, he's going to talk for 6 chapters, and then they're just going to move on. The whole thing is very strange. And so it leads the commentators to ask what's going on, traditional commentators as well as the critical schools. And so what I want to do is show you a few different approaches to what Elihu is doing here. These approaches are not mutually exclusive. You could legitimately adopt more than one of them. The first one I want to show you is the Rambam, Maimonides, source number 2, describing Elihu. He says, "V'amar dvarim v'chidot nifla'ot." He, Elihu, spoke in mysterious words and riddles. "Kishiyis bonein b'dvarav hamis bonein." When someone who contemplates looks at what he does, yisma, he will be in shock. He'll be at least surprised. "V'achshov shelo amar dvar nosaf al mashe amar Elifazu b'ldad v'tzofar." And he'll think that, you know, this fellow didn't add anything new. He's saying the same thing that the three visitors said. All he's done is put their words in different words and added perhaps in their explanation. He doesn't abandon this, I wrote in acid tone for translation of Kihui. I think that's a good rendering of it. He is as acerbic as they are and more so. You'll see, he's a master of the insult. Chapter 32 is a study in how to be rude. Like he really is. You'll see it. And he rebukes Job. Vitar Hashem b'yosher v'siper nifloosav b'mitziot. He describes God as just. He speaks of God's wonders in the world. V'shehu yisbarach lo yargish b'avodas ha'oved v'lo b'mered ha'moreid v'ha'moreh. God isn't affected by somebody's worship. God isn't affected by somebody's rebellion. V'elu ha'inyanim kulam kvar marum chaverav. But his friends said all of these things already. So what's he adding? Especially when he's going to put in a lot of effort to convincing us that he's there to tell us what's right, because nobody else knows. Aval im histaklut, im ahistaklut hatov, yizbayer locha hanyan anasaf asher hevi. He says, if you examine it well, you'll see what he is adding. V'hu haya hakavana. It is the intent. V'lo kadam hanyan ahu lezula so mehen. It's something that doesn't appear in any other. But yeah, along with that, he's going to say everything that they said. He's going to repeat what everybody else said in order to respond to it. Just like Job did, just like the visitors did, where they rehashed what somebody else said and then responded. He says the goal that they have when they repeat what somebody else says is essentially to oversimplify it and to remove that which is unique and special about what the other one said in order to make it sound like they all agree on one view. But it's not so. They don't all agree. That which Elihu added, none of them had mentioned. And it's in his lesson of the Malach's intercession, which we'll get to. That's in chapter 33. I'm not going into the specifics of what he adds, as much as Rambam's view is that, yes, Elihu is going to rehash a lot of what the others have said, because that's the style of the book. And there will be nuances of difference in what Elihu has to say that we are going to have to tease out. We have to figure out what he's talking about. And that's one approach. Rabbeinu Bachya, or Bachaye, it's written both ways, offers a different approach. Well, it's not entirely different. It's an overlapping approach. He suggests, yes, Elihu is adding something new. Elihu is meant to represent Judaism. In other words, Job is not Jewish. His three visitors weren't Jewish. Elihu is the Jew in the story. That's the way that Rabbeinu Bachya takes him. Others also view him as Jewish. That's not his unique point of view. Rashi believes he's Jewish. Ibn Ezra seems to believe that he's Jewish as well. And the goal then is, if he's Jewish, he represents Judaism. So, for example, if you take a look at source number 3, Rabbeinu Bachya notes that Elihu is going to be introduced to us as Mimishpachat Ram, from the Ram family. What is the Ram family? You act as though we should know what the Ram family is. Not the printing press Ram family. Different Ram family. From the family of Avraham, Mimishpachat Avraham, Shaya Shoresh HaEmunah, who was the root of faith. In other words, Elihu is introduced as being from the Ram family. It means the Jewish family, the descendants of Avram, Abram, who becomes, of course, Avraham. Ha'ish hazeh Elihu chara po'aliyov, v'haya be'inav taweh. He was outraged at Job. He thought Job was straying. V'chein chara po'alachaverim kasher hishiyu. And he's outraged at the friends who accused Job of wickedness. Aval yatzdik oso. Ach lo yatzdikenu me'elokim le'mor ki ha'kel yisvarach yaveit mishpato. He says, Elihu walks a middle path. He finds Job to be righteous, just not more righteous than God. He's angry at Eliphaz, because Eliphaz said, you must have sinned and you're a terrible person. And Elihu is not willing to walk that path. But he's not willing to walk Job's path either of God must be wrong. There has to be some other approach that Elihu is going to try to adopt as Rabbeinu Bachaye reads him. And that's why he says, when you get to chapter 42, you will find that God is going to accuse the visitors, the other three visitors, of guilt. He's going to blame them for their arguments. God is going to say they have to bring a korban, they have to bring a burnt offering to atone for what they've said, because they're so wrong. God doesn't blame Elihu. He doesn't require any atonement from Elihu. It must be that what he said is different, because otherwise God would have blamed him too. There has to be something new. So again, Rambam is saying Elihu is a visitor who is going to say something that's going to be new, even though it doesn't sound like it. There is something different. Rabbeinu Bachya is saying he actually is the voice of Judaism. And he is going to say something that is new and different. You have to figure out how, but there is a difference. He's not going to take the path of indicting Job. He's not going to take the path of indicting God. That's not the accurate representation of what Judaism would want. There is something else that he is going to articulate, and that is going to be the path of Elihu in the book, and God is going to say, that's right. That's the correct path. In other words, this is going to set the stage for God's speech, essentially. Clear? Are we? We're good? Okay. Sure. That's the second approach. Third approach is the approach of Dat Mikra. And Dat Mikra, that's the edition I've been using all along, adds an element to this. Again, not necessarily exclusive of what's been said before, but he views Elihu's purpose in this book as laying the groundwork for what God is going to say. It's a segue into God's speeches. So if you take a look at source number 4, Kavanas hadvarim b'fi Elihu shonemi kavanasam b'fi hareim. The intent of Elihu's speech is different from that of the friends. B'divrei Elihu yesh dvarim ha'asidim lihisparesh ulihisrachei b'maneh Hashem li'iyov. Elihu's words include words which will be explained and broadened when God speaks. He says, you can conclude from this that Elihu's words are preparation for the revelation of God. Because what God is going to say is wildly different from what Job is anticipating. Right? Job has been spending the book thinking, God doesn't talk to me, God isn't interested in answering me, and if God does speak, it's going to be to shut me down. What God's going to say is different, and it requires some kind of preparation. And that's what Elihu will provide. Elihu starts with things that are more like what Job expected were going to be said. But then, then he curves towards what God is going to say. And in the end, he even hints that God is going to be revealed. So the Dat Mikra's approach is that this is a preparation for God's speeches. Clear? Now, in the three views that we've just reviewed here, Rambam's view, Rabbeinu Bachaye's view, Dat Mikra's view. Is Elihu, so to speak, a real person? Is Elihu being depicted as a human being?
Is anybody a real person? Like, or is this Carolus's play?
That's the other question. The point that Devi is making, I think, is the key question. Way, way back, right? This is week 50. So 49 weeks ago, we talked about the question of whether this book is a parable or whether it is a report of actual dialogue, whether it's verbatim reproduction of their words or whether it's just, you know, afterwards some kind of artistic rendering of conversations that took place. If I read the Dat Mikra's approach, Elihu is a literary device, and they could all be literary devices. They don't have to be real people. This doesn't have to be an event that took place. It's simply God's view is going to be presented here, and we need to lay the groundwork. I'm getting details. That's one way to look at it. If I take the view of Mora Nevuchim, of the Rambam, in his Guide of the Perplexed, is Elihu a real person, or is he just a literary device in this? I think he's more towards Elihu being a real person, even though Rambam himself has said, Maimonides has said that the whole thing is a parable.
Rambam usually depersonifies elements.
Certainly in this book he has declared his belief that it's a parable.
Yeah. The, like him, though.
Right. And Rabbeinu Bachya, or Bachaye,
could be Hashem himself, if representing Judaism, then it might be a real person.
But what does that mean? God in the book, or God meaning God sent somebody? What are you? In other words, I'm trying to ask the question of whether this is a two-dimensional or three-dimensional story, right? Are there people, or is this all just written on a page? That's what I'm getting at. Oh boy. Rita.
It could be either. The way it's presented, it could be either.
I think Rabbeinu Bachya is the only one who really seems to be viewing him as a person. But even there, you're right. It could be a device. It's representing Judaism. It doesn't mean that it's actually these are people and he's the Jew who showed up on the scene. You know, no, but it could be just on the page. Okay, we presented these different ideas. Now we're going to present the Jewish idea. So here's a character, and we're going to depict him as being, you know, of Jewish heritage. Carla and Achena.
Just wondering if you shouldn't distinguish between real characters and narrative characters.
Yeah.
And there is some sort of a narrative going on with voices. Now, of course, the whole thing, the major character is the discourse itself.
Yeah.
And the various voices are given a name, a face, a role to play and speak in a certain order. So in that sense, Elihu is probably as real or unreal as the other characters. Hashem himself is a character in this this whole...
Right. And that goes back to Debbie's point. He's as real as anybody else's.
Right. So I mean, to speak as a real persons, I mean, that's
going
way too far, I think. I mean,
I have a reason for asking this question. I'm going somewhere with this. Yeah, Shana.
I agree with Rabbeinu Bachya. Really does view him as a person, and I think it's particularly because he gives him an emotion, and that emotion is in a text.
Mm-hmm.
He gets angry.
Yep.
Which neither Rambam nor Dat Mikra addresses.
Right. There is a sense of humanity to him. And thank you for putting your finger on that. I think that's an important point. Elisheva.
In the sense that all this pattern of not really bringing anything new, or and circuitous, in that sense, he could be just as real as anybody else. So we would think that he's real according to what they're saying by their descriptions of him. So if he's followed the same other people before, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zohar, who also give, perhaps, arguments that have been said before, they were doing different, things that have been said, he could be as real as them. So in that sense, he has that in common.
Right.
He could be a real person.
Right. The reason why I asked this question, and this goes to really what everybody here has said, most strongly to what Shana was saying, but I think what everybody has said is touched on it, is he's going to be introduced with human traits. In other words, if you want to present this story, and really the only reason to have this story here is because you want to get at the speeches, and not because not because these are real people. You just, here's one point of view, here's a second point of view, here's a third point of view. You don't need all the biographical details. The Gemara asked this question. This was an old question. In the very beginning, remember, when we were discussing whether this ever happened or not, we pointed out that the Gemara itself asked regarding Job, did he ever live? And when the view was put forth that he was a mashal, that he was a parable, the Gemara said, what do you mean? It says he lived in the land of Uz. And the answer was, no. You can make that up also. But the point is, why are you presenting biographical details if this isn't a real person? Is it because that's going to make the reader any more interested in sitting through six chapters of Elihu? like, you don't have enough here to keep me interested. That's what you're trying to do. What's the goal? It sort of reminds me of my Beit Midrash had a program that we did for a few years on our Shabbat Zonim in different shuls. We did something called Shir Theater, in which we took a shir and converted it into play format, into dramatic format, and you'd have different people speaking different roles. And we were conscious of the need to include some form of action and some form of personality for the speakers. It couldn't just be this was going to present one thing, this was going to present another thing, because that's, you know, dull and harder to follow than a shir. You need it to be interesting. But we're going to get biography for Elihu. We're going to get emotion for Elihu. We're going to get age for Elihu. And the question is, if he's really just a literary device, why are you telling me these things? Carla?
Isn't that the power of fiction? Meaning? Lahavdil, but little Red Riding Hood, we have a bio, we have a description of her. She does things, but it is a story.
Right.
So the fact that you fill in and give some dimension to a character doesn't make a character any more real. It just makes the story or the argument easier to consume.
So, that's not the way I look at Little Red Riding Hood, right? I look at Little Red Riding Hood like a five-year-old, right? It's a nice story. It may convey all sorts of messages and philosophical points about I don't know what, but at the end of the day, it's a story.
Tolstoy is War and Peace, not for a five-year-old. I'm just thinking that the discussion seems to focus on, unless I misunderstand, like, did this actually take place? Are we talking about real people? Or are we talking about something that, well, a parable, of course, is a lesson, but it's fiction the way it's set up. It's coming from the mind of somebody who wrote this and wanted to convey a message.
Right.
And fills it in with character. Like you say, you're playing out your sheer.
Right. So what I'm getting at is, we have to ask ourselves, if this is a parable, like Maimonides argues, like is suggested as a view in the Talmud, and certainly as is popular today to read it, if it really is a parable, then as we read the characteristics of Elihu, we have to ask, what are they there for? What are they there to teach me? What am I supposed to gain from it? And I think that's important because it will add a dimension to it. Take a look at number 5, please, on your sheet. And you'll get a sense of where I'm going with this. Newsom writes, "The inexhaustible source of human discourse lies in the fundamentally perspectival," which I don't think is a word, but fine, "perspectival nature of claims to truth. What Kenneth Burke calls its, quote, contexts of situation. A stalled conversation is reinvigorated by someone eccentric to the original discourse." Someone who wasn't part of the conversation, who's going to approach it from a different angle. And that's what you do. That's what you refresh or reinvigorate, as she says, the conversation. You bring a new idea because you're coming at it from a new perspective. And that, she says, and I think is right, is why he's presented the way he is. He's presented as somebody who is younger than everybody else, and that's why he waited until the end. You'll see that explicitly in the verses in a minute or two. So her idea is that it's not just somebody who is younger, but it's but who is roughly the equal of everybody. This is a younger generation. People who read the dialogue and respond with ideas that may not be all that different, but will frame the debate differently. I mean, she herself, Newsom herself, is a believer in the idea that this is actually a later reader, a next generation, and it's being put into the text. That's her approach. But I don't think we even need to go that route in order to adopt the idea that this is meant to convey somebody later who is seeing what's going on, who's been there for the dialogues, and says, you know, where I'm at, I'm the new generation. From the way I see things, you have it all wrong. The facts are right, but we should be looking at this differently. And so I want us to keep that in mind as we read through this. What is it that's being done differently by this younger person who is who's reading the story? Or who's not reading, who's witnessing the story. Yeah. Well, younger is going to be explicit in the verses. and her leap is the generation. The reason, the way she gets the idea that it's a later generation is because she tries to find parallels between what Elihu says and other texts of that period based on the dating of the book. That's where she's trying to get that idea from. It's a few dozen pages of that. Okay, so let's take a look now. Chapters 32 and 33 are Elihu's first speech. I gave you a rough outline on the page, and you can see for yourself that chapter 32 is basically harangue, more or less. It's going to start with an introduction, as we'll see. It's going to move into Elihu talking to the three visitors and telling them how disappointed he is in them. And then he's going to address the room in general, but he's really still talking about the visitors. And then he's going to turn to Job and say, Job, answer me if you can. And that's where he's going to be, chapter 33. And then he's going to start moving into the substance of what he has to say. But he's going to spend an entire chapter, 22 verses, building up the importance of what it is that he's about to say. So this is somebody who clearly believes that he has to say something important. So chapter 32, sentence 1, is page 1661, if you're using the Art Scroll Tanakh. Yeah?
It makes the person, or the concept, Elihu, very human by the introduction that he has to be waiting, winding himself up, ready to explode, and now
he's... You got it. It sure sounds human to me.
Yeah.
The Pasuk Aleph, sentence 1. Vayish bisu shloshes ha'anashim ha'ele me'ano, says Iyov. These three men stopped answering Job, right? Remember that, again, the immediately preceding chapters, he has given his final speech with part 1 and his final speech part 2. He described the injustice done to him, what he had before, what he has lost. God won't answer him. He has sworn multiple times to his righteousness. So they say, okay, enough. Why? Kihut Tzaddik Be'enav, because he thinks he's right. Right? Tzaddik, remember, we've said before, has multiple layers to it. Tzaddik meaning righteous, or Tzaddik meaning the winner of the dispute. Hey, enough already. It's not that they agree with him. We don't agree, but we're not getting anywhere. So, you know, maybe it's time that we just stop talking. On the other hand, what Job has requested, which is sympathetic companionship, isn't here either. It's not as though they stop talking and they just put their arm around him and say, oh, Job, we feel terrible for you. No, they just stop talking, and they're still in the room. And I say that because Elihu is going to address them, and God is going to address them in chapter 42. That's why I believe that they're still here. Vayichar af Elihu, we're going to try to go a little bit quickly with this, week 50. Vayicharaf Elihu ben Barach el habuzi mimishpachat Ram. The anger of Elihu, son of Barach el of Buz, from the family of Ram. He is angry. You notice the way the genealogy is presented? This is much more than we got with Eliphaz Tzofar and Bildad. We're getting much more detail than we had with those. This one was from Teman. This one was the Shuchi. So far was the Naamati, and that was basically it. Here we get who his father is. We get where they're from. We get the broader family. This is something more. Before I read the second half of the sentence, pausing there. Elihu, and I answered Debbie last week. Elihu is either Kaili, who, he is my God, or who, like Hovem, my God exists. That's the meaning of this. Barach El, one who blesses God. And I think not blaspheme the reversal like we've seen elsewhere in the book, but literally a blesser of God. This fellow, Be'yov chara'apo al tzadiko nafsho me'elokim. First of all, he's angry at Job, because Job has held himself to be either more righteous than God or victorious over God. That's number one. And then number two, uvishlosh esrayav chara'apo. He's also angry at his three friends. Ala sherlo matzu maneh, because they didn't find the proper response, vayarshiyu es Iyov, and all they did was say, Job, you must be a bad man. So he's angry at everybody. He's in good company in this book. I saw in my notes, I scrambled things a little bit more on his genealogy. We already saw that the statement of from the Ram family is taken by Rabbeinu Bachya to mean that he's Jewish, from the family of Avraham. So that's actually a passage in Talmud Yerushalmi. If you take a look at source number 6. Talmud Yerushalmi. Well, it's not. Well, you'll see. There are two different views in the Yerushalmi. First view, Darash Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva taught. Vayicharaf Elihu ben Barachiel Abuzimi Mishpachat Ram. Elihu, son of Barachiel, the Buzi from the Ram family, was outraged. Elihu zeb Bilam. Elihu is a reference to Bilam.
That makes it much more interesting.
Yeah, doesn't it? Well, the question is what we're trying to accomplish here. But he is Bilam ben Barachel, son of Barachel, Shabalek Halel es Yisrael uberchan. He tried to curse Israel and he ended up blessing them. Habuzi. What is buzi? So we take buz like degradation, disgrace. Shahaita nevoato bizuya. No fail ugluyenayim. His prophecy was degraded, disgraced. As is described in the verse, he falls and then his eyes are open. He can't prophesy while standing up. A midrashic point that's made regarding the inferiority of his type of prophecy. Mi mishpachat Ram, from the Ram family, they quote the verse, Min Aram yancheni Balak. When he introduces himself, he says, Balak guided me from Aram. So Ram is Aram. Aram by the Euphrates. So according to this read, according to Rabbi Akiva's read, Elihu is a bad man. We do not like Bilam whatsoever. He thinks he is privy to what God has to say, but in fact he has it wrong.
And there goes the Yichus.
Yeah. There goes the Yichus is right. And the Shidduch at the same time. It's true. But that's the idea. Bilam is this person who is presumptuous, and we are going to see presumptuous written all over this person in the book. So he has Bilam's presumptuousness, and he is a bad man, according to Rabbi Akiva. And then you get Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, who says, no. Amar la Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, ain hu hu. He says, no. I'm sorry, not ain hu hu. In hu hu, kvar kisa alav hamakom. If he was really him, in Aramaic is like yes. So if it's true that he's really the same person, then kivar kisa alav hamakom. God has already hidden it by not calling him Bilam. He called him Elihu instead. So therefore, who are you to say that? Vein lesu, and if he's not him, asilis vakeach imach. He's going to dispute you. How dare you call me Bilam? That's what Elihu was going to say. Ella Elihu is a Yitzchak. He says, no, you have it wrong. Elihu is a good man. Elihu is Yitzchak. Elihu is Isaac. Ben Barach El, son of Barach El, Ben Shebircho Hakel. Shnemar Vayvarcheu Hashem, the one who God blessed. Because the Torah says explicitly that God blesses Isaac. Vayvarcheu Hashem. Habuzi of Buz. He disgraced all of the houses of idolatry when he allowed himself to be bound up on the altar. Mimishpachat Ram, from the family of Ram, son of Avram, ben Avram. Two wildly different ways to look at this person of Elihu. One approach saying that he is terrible, and the other approach saying that he is wonderful. And again, part of this is because it's just so hard to understand what it is that he's saying based on his words. You could actually do that. You get this ambivalence regarding Elihu in the words of the sages. You have Rabbi Akiva who says bad, and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah who says good. Okay? So that means that we shouldn't feel bad about not entirely understanding what in the world he's saying. We really have two different views of who he is. So,
yeah, but two extreme views.
Yes. Two extremely different views. That is correct. So he's from the Ram family, which the Yerushalmi says then could be Aram, could be Avram, Rashi takes the view that it's Abraham. Ibn Ezra, interestingly, takes it from the book of Ruth. The genealogy at the end of Ruth. Ram is one of those generations. His name was actually Ram, which is a bonus over like Aram and Avram. No, there's somebody named Ram. So that's the approach that Ibn Ezra takes, also identifying him then as Jewish. And then Buzi, Ibn Ezra says, you know, there is Nahor's son whose name was Buz. If you remember the genealogy, when they tell you about Rivka's birth in Bereishit chapter 22, I gave you the references on the sheet in source number 7, but you don't need to look it up right now. But there is this person from the greater Avram family whose name is Buz. So maybe it can fit. Either way, this is all challenging, but everyone's wrestling with two questions at once, really. They're dealing with the question of, is this a good man or a bad man? And separate, meaning, do we like what he has to say or not? And separately, why is the Navi giving me all this detail about the names of his family and where he's from? What kind of message are they trying to convey to us? And that's really what's feeding into this discussion. Okay. So he's offended, this fellow Elihu, who may be Jewish, may not be Jewish, might be Bilam, might be Yitzhak, might be a literary device. Yeah. He is offended and angry at Job, because Job declares himself the winner. He's angry and offended at the visitors because they stopped short of saying what they should have said, and instead they blamed Job, and he doesn't like that. And so, Pasuk Dalet, sentence 4, Ve'elihu chika es Iyov bidvarim. Elihu waited for Job with his words. He listened to what everybody had to say. Ki zekeinim hema mimenu liyamim, because they were older. They were senior. And you may recall in the very beginning of the book, I told you that I thought, Dan Mikra mentioned it, that Eliphaz was the oldest of the three, and then Bildad, and then Sofar. And Sharon asked me at the time, how do you know that from the book? And the answer was, because they present as sort of, this is the most senior, and we pointed out different characteristics of the speakers. It's very clear here that we are saying the youngest has to wait for last. So Elihu is waiting, politely we think, for the end. That's what he does. He says, I'm going to wait until they're all done, and then I'm going to speak up. Elihu sees that the three visitors have nothing to say. And he is angry. The funny thing about this is that as angry as he sounds, because the visitors haven't said what they should say, and because they indicted Job, he's going to indict Job also. So the question is, what in the world am I supposed to make of this? Yeah?
He could assume that they should have, after this whole ado, should have apologized.
Who should have apologized?
The three.
The three?
To Job.
Okay.
After all, he is in an inferior position. He's a victim no matter what.
Okay.
They have insulted him willingly or unwillingly.
Oh, willingly. Yeah.
And unwillingly. There must have been some tension. It's over now. At the very least, they should leave with some kind of, we feel sorry for you anyway. He might be as offensive as they are, but maybe he will motivate his feelings better than they have.
Good luck.
This is from the onset.
Yes. Right.
Maybe he wants to provide closure, because obviously there's a stalemate before he starts speaking.
Yeah, so how is he providing closure?
Well, he's not succeeding, but maybe that's the intention. That's
the intention of... Even though he's...
It's not properly finished. Not really. I mean...
Well, it stopped, yes, rather than concluded. Right. The... take a look at source number 8.
In some kind of a Shiva setting, closure is not the aim.
Well, no, there's definitely no closure for Job. That's for sure. But you're talking about closure for the dialogue, not closure for Job. But take a look at number 8 at what Rashi says. Rashi says, well, not typo, but correction. He says, when the verse 3 says that Bayashiu et Io, he's angry that they have indicted Job, it's actually a scribal correction. He says, this is one of the verses for which the text was amended by scribes. It should have said, they indicted God with their silence. That's what it should have said. Because that's really what he's angry about. Rashi says that Elihu's role here is to defend God, and he's angry at the three visitors because since they didn't say what they had to say to Job, as he said twice here, that they didn't have a response, they have allowed God to look bad. That's the way that Rashi reads it, and frankly, I think it's very consistent with the text. When it says that Elihu was angry because they blamed Job, what he really means is Elihu was angry because they led to blame of God. That's Rashi's read. However, Ibn Ezra has to read this differently, because Ibn Ezra says no. Uchtiv, in source number 9, Kihumi tikun sofrim. It is written that this was from the scribal emendations, that somehow this was a change. V'ha'omim kein yadu mashinela mimeni. Those who say there's no something I don't. Ibn Ezra says, in classic Ibn Ezra style, he thinks they have it wrong. That in fact Elihu believes that they're wrong for blaming Job. And so what we're going to have to do as we read this is figure out what is Elihu's attitude to Job. According to Rashi, Elihu is anti-Job. Just as anti as the others were, and if anything, he's just angry because the others didn't go far enough. Whereas Ibn Ezra believes that Elihu is a Job defender, and that he's genuinely angry that they have bashed Job. Okay? So we're going to have to read this with two different schools of thought in mind. Not easy, but Job. So what we have then is, so far, Elihu is youngest. Elihu is angry. He believes that the answers given by the others were either insufficient in that they stopped short, or bad for blaming Job and not giving appropriate answers. Right? Those are your two possibilities of why he's angry at the visitors. And he's angry at Job, because Job, you have no business saying that you're more righteous than God. Got it? So the things to remember about Elihu: disagreeable and young. That's what we have. So let's now go into the beginning of his address to the visitors, because he hasn't even said a word yet. Vayan Elihu ben Barach El Habuzi. We get the full lineage. Elihu, son of Barach El Habuzi. Source in verse 6 declares Vayomar, and he says, Sa'ir ani li'amim v'atem yeshishim. I'm young, you're old. I'm sure that went over well. Al kein zachalti va'ira mechavos dei eschem. Therefore, I was afraid to be zochel. Is often a word used with the way snake travels in the kind of squiggly way. But here it's understood as an expression of fear. I was afraid. Va'ira mechavos dei eschem. I was afraid to speak with you. I was afraid to express my mind, because who am I? I am just a kid. By the way, the phrase zachalti va'ira comes up in the Yom Kippur Masar. The person approaching God says zachalti va'ira. Amarti is just another case in which weird passages from Job end up in popular liturgy. Amarti yamim yedaberu. I said, you know what? Let age speak. Virov shanim yodiu chokhma. Many years will convey wisdom, will convey knowledge. Achein, verse 8. Achein ruach hi be'enosh v'nishmat shakai tevinim. But you know what? I was wrong. It's become clear to me that wisdom is a spirit from God. It is the breath of shakai, this name for God, that provides people with understanding. What has he really said? Where's the insult in this?
I don't have wisdom.
Well, he says, age isn't cutting it. I thought, because you're older than me, you're going to say something sharp. I guess that wisdom doesn't really come with age, does it? That's what he said. He says, Lo rabim yechkamu. I'm reading it the way most commentators read it. There are multiple ways to read this line, but he says, Lo rabim yechkamu, people of many years don't necessarily become wise. Uz kedim yavinu mishpat, and the elderly don't necessarily understand justice. It's just, you know, age ain't all it's cracked up to be. Therefore, L'chayn amarti shimali, so I say, listen to me, Achaved de'iyaf ani, I'm going to convey my view. Hein hochalti l'dibreichem, because I've waited for your words. Azin anetbunoseichem, I gave ear to your understanding. Ad tachkirun milin, until you would investigate words. Ve'adeichem es bonan, and for you I contemplated. I was waiting. V'hinei ein li Yov mochiach. But there's no one here who's going to rebuke Job. You realize how harsh it sounds to suddenly hear his name thrown in? Like, no one has referred to him by name in their conversations. He's the only one who does it. Oneh amarav mikem. I thought there would be someone among you who would respond to his words. Panetomru matzanu chachma. But he said, lest you say that you have found wisdom, meaning that in Job's words you have found wisdom. Kel yidfenu below ish. God will be the one who will respond to him, not a human being. Velo arach elai milin. Job's words don't have any value to me, or haven't been opposed to me. Uve imrechem lo ashivenu, and I won't respond to him as you did. We are now, for those keeping score, in sentence 14. He's been speaking since sentence 6, plus you had 5 verses of introduction. Has he said anything yet?
No, but he's becoming more human by the minute.
Yeah,
he's valuing the other three who are his seniors and for whom he politely waited to speak. And
yes.
Now he insults them.
Oh, you betcha.
And he excused himself from not saying anything until now.
Yeah, and I'll add one more note. Take a look at source number 10. Mitzudat David adds insult to insult. He says, why is it that Elihu insists on saying, you know, I was sitting here all along and I was biting my tongue, but my ideas were with me from the beginning? He says, Du'u, you should know, Masha shatakti adhena, the fact that I was silent until now, lo haya bavur ki lo yadati ma lo hashiv, v'ata lamadati ma midivreichem. It's not that I didn't know what to say, and I've been learning from you what I ought to say. Lo chenu, don't think that. Ki atshuva nechona b'fi me'az. He said, my answer's been in my mouth all along. But because I was young, so I said I won't speak up. In other words, I haven't learned a thing. I've been sitting here, right, for 31 chapters, and I haven't picked up a single idea from anything that any of you said. All along, I've been waiting. Man, we know people like this, right? That's the truth of the matter is, there are people like that. They're in a conversation, and their answer is ready in their mouths, and therefore they don't learn a thing from what the other person has to say. But he's proud of it. Like, yeah, that's exactly the point. I've been sitting there all along. Not a thing that you have said has affected me yet. He's just, you know, eventually you'll see what I'm going to say. It's like an infomercial, right? Just wait another minute. I'm going to tell you. This is going to be it. Yeah.
I would suggest that it's exactly the opposite.
Yeah.
The question you ask is because what he says is so subtle. Every word he uses is a subtle word and really proves a nuisance point.
Meaning that
this is just beautiful theater.
Oh, yes.
It's just written so well.
Yep. Yes. I mean, this is the character. This is who he is. This is what we want to convey. Absolutely. I mean, Newsom doesn't spend as much time on, and it would be good if she did, frankly, the antagonism part of it. She likes to focus much more on the youth piece of it. But the antagonism, I think, has to be part of this also. It's part of what this Sefer, what this book is here to tell me. Whether I view it as people who actually had this dialogue, or whether I view it as something that was written as a parable for us and the Great Assembly thought was good enough that they put it into the canon. Either way, the antagonism has to somehow be more than just entertainment. Especially if there's going to be a full chapter and then some of it. So let's keep on reading because I want to get through chapter 32.
I think if there's antagonism, it takes away from the credibility of what he has to say.
Could be. But then the question is, then why bring him?
That's for something.
You bring him to dismiss him. Take a look at sentence 15. He turns to the room. Chatu! Lo anu od. He's now describing them in third person. He's talking about the visitors. He says, chatuch, this is a term for fear. These people, they're frightened. Lo anu od. They have no other things to say. Hetiku mehem milim. Words have become too difficult for them, or words have moved away from them. Vehochalti. I waited. Ki lo yidaberu. To the point where they wouldn't speak. Ki amdu lo anu od. Because they've stopped. They're not saying anything anymore. Now I will present my view. This is the chest-thumping part. I'm going to present my view. I'm going to express my opinion. Ki malesi milim, because I am full of words. Hetzikasni ruach bitni, the spirit that is in me, the spirit sent by God, it pains me inside. I have so much to say. Hine vitni kiyayin lo yipaseach. He says, my belly is like a wineskin that is not opened, and the wine is just building inside. The ke'ovos chadashim yibakeah, like brand new skins, or brand new barrels, it will split open from the wine, as opposed to an old barrel, which already has the flexibility. The new barrel is going to split open. I can't take it. Adavara, I'm going to speak. V'yirvachli, and that will at least release the tension inside of me. Eftach sfasai ve'eneh, I will open my lips and I will respond. Al na esapneish, I am going to show favor to no man. Ve'el adam lo achaneh, I am not going to change my words for anyone in order to mask the harshness. Kilo yadati achaneh. He says, I don't know how to play politics. I don't know how to be polite to people. I don't know how to change what I have to say and say it in ways that people will accept. Kimat yisaeni oseni. There are a couple of ways to take these last few words. One way to take it is, may God remove me from this world if I know how to speak diplomatically. Ibn Ezra says, may God burn me if I speak diplomatically. He says, I have no diplomacy in me. I have no desire to speak that way. I wouldn't know how to speak that way. It's not who I am. And I am going to tell you like it is. He just spent an entire chapter doing this. He has said nothing. It's true. It's beautiful theater. Absolutely true. And yes, he has explained to us a little bit about who he is and where he's coming from, and that's going to affect the way we take his words. I just find it remarkable that he hasn't said anything.
He's sort of blaming the others for also not having said anything.
And he blames them for not having said anything.
He also comes across as someone who really is craving for attention. And it doesn't really make a difference where he is.
You wonder if he's sort of upset that no one turned to him until now and said, hey, maybe you have something to say.
Maybe he doesn't even know Egov.
Well, he's
just fits in one room, right?
Yeah.
You've got to sort of picture this whole thing.
Yeah.
After Satan and God have their little chat and da 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 da. So it's like this. I'm just sitting there like this thing. Listen to these assholes. I'm going to speak in a minute, right?
Maybe. I mean, the question fundamentally that you have to deal with when you look at this is the question that we started with an hour ago, right? Which is, what is his role in this book? Why is he here? What is he meant to present for me? And you have the Rambam who says there will be new elements in here. There's going to be something new here. His intent is different from the others. He's not here to educate Job. He's here to do something else in this conversation. Is that what's going on? And is he to present new ideas in that sense? Is he here to represent Judaism? If he is, he's doing a very poor job of it, quite frankly. If this is the good guy, then you sort of wonder... is he there to lay the groundwork for Hashem's remarks? Again, what was this first chapter about? What was this doing here? Or, frankly, this makes Newsom's argument compelling. This is a younger generation with its own point of view, and this is the way a younger generation expresses itself when there's a generation gap. Right? That's the way they talk. They say, you old folks don't understand. I'm going to tell you from my view, because my view matters, and so on and so forth. It gives credence to her approach when you look at this chapter of introduction. So what we're going to have to do, God willing, next week, is see chapter 33, where he will eventually say something of meaning. About a third of the way into the chapter, he's going to start to speak substantively. And we'll have to see what, if anything, is going to add to what's been said before. Thank you.